Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's guest on the Yahoo Sports Hockey Podcast has both bark and bite. He's a Canadiens analyst for RDS, a seven-season veteran in the NHL, and one of the best pound-for-pound fighters in the history of the game. It's none other than PJ Stock. PJ, how you doing, man?
I'm good. Thanks. Nice build-up. Nice. Thank you. Thanks for not bringing up any of my stats.
No, I tried to build it up before I tear you down a little later.
Thanks very much.
So we're going to talk some Canadians today, which is something sure. You do regularly on L'Antichambre. I hope I said that even close to being correct. We're also going to touch on the Tim Peel controversy because that's hot right now. But while I have you, I got to talk about something you did, and you mentioned the stats, but something you did actually really incredibly well in your career, which is to exchange punches with other humans. So, I mean, you have the absolute craziest videos on hockeyfights.com, the database there. I feel like I have to ask you where that all came from. Like, not just the ability to scrap, but to literally just test chins with another man, like shot for shot style of fighting. How does that even come to fruition?
Well, since we live in a PC world right now, I got to preference it by saying violence is not a solution to anything. And the whole, it was a different time. It was just a real different time. And I played, the dream that I always had was to go to an American university growing up. It was just growing up, you watched Notre Dame football, New Year's Eve, New Year's Day was the big college football game. And growing up in Montreal, it's we glorified the American university institutes. And I thought that, that's where I wanted to go. And I headed down that path, never pro hockey, but I was heading down that path. I went to play in a league, which was a university would come watch you play. It was called Pembroke, Ontario, the CJHL. And it's not a violent league. It's not, even though we're going back, 25 years, we had cages on. It was more for kids getting ready to go to the next level, study-wise. And then midway through that, I made a change to go to Victoriaville to play in the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League. And yeah. I kept playing my same way that I played in Pembroke. And, this way was different because they had role players in junior, which you didn't have in the other junior league. So I'd go and hit someone. And after I hit someone, I'd get some 6'3" guy coming over and saying, "You can't hit that guy." I'm like, "What do you mean I can't hit that guy?" And he goes, "This is why. Boom, right in your head." And then it was just different times, right? And
right.
So it was something that I adjusted to. I found a liking to continue to play the role of hockey that I played. And got better at defending myself. And everyone knows everything's between the ears, and it just came to more confidence. And I love going to rinks and having people boo me and having been cheered at my own rink. And that role was something that just, I never wanted to do that. I never went into a game thinking I'm going to do that. And it just, that's how the player that I evolved into. And you talked about the ones on YouTube or whatever, I thank the Lord that there were some tough men. There were some real tough guys. And I know with all the science and everything that it's not really encouraged in today's game, but it was a fun time. And when it was okay to do, and I did it for a reason. And it was obviously so much to do with your teammates and the score and retribution and intimidation. And I was lucky, but to have a chance to play in the league, and that was my role. That was my role, and I love doing it.
You mentioned tough guys, and you mentioned 6'3" monsters in junior that you were just all of a sudden, you know, coming into contact with. And that was sort of a theme for you, was you're always having to fight guys that were bigger than you. So what was the key for you to hang with bigger guys in fights?
The key was actually, it's funny, I tell the story when I talk sometimes, that I, you know, growing up, we had VHS tapes with our VCRs back in the day. And I only had two movies in my repertoire in the house. And it was, one was Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves with Kevin Costner. And the other one was Rocky IV. And so that's all, you come home from school, you put in your VHS tape. And I just, it's just a mentality. I love so many of those sports movies that have, you know, the messaging behind it. And the Rocky one was obviously the story of the underdog and having to adapt to find a guy much different and bigger than him. And Rocky IV is exactly that. And the whole thing is about, just don't go down. You know what? You just don't go down. You got to do something different to beat this guy. Don't let him get the best of you. And his corner is always like, you know, don't go down. Just don't go down. And that became kind of my mentality in those fisticuffs. That was kind of, you know what? Just don't go down. Just don't go down. Change. What can you do differently to get the better of him? Just don't go down. And it was crazy times, but fun times. And I guess I had to. Funny enough that I'm quoting Rocky, but it was my two weeks. If my parents would have had a different VHS tape back then, maybe things would have turned out differently.
Well, I'm a little ashamed to admit that my VHS of choice coming home from school was Spice World, which is probably why I wasn't able to hang in fights when I was growing up.
But you can dance.
I actually can't. I don't think I absorbed anything from those movies, unfortunately. You mentioned not being the one to stop. I mean, that is the one big thing that you actually notice from your fights, is that you are never the guy who stops. Did you pride yourself on that?
I pride myself on, like I said, I had to do things differently than the other guys did to me. So they're obviously bigger and stronger and had a lot, you know, weight. And there was some things, you know, I'd have to change hands, because you think of, you know, you go back and watch old tapes. It's a one guy holding another guy out like this. And I was too small. I wasn't strong enough. So I had to learn to adapt. I got hit one time in junior by a guy named Paul Shantz that hit me with a left hand. And I went to the ground. Right? Supposedly, I got right back up really quickly. But it was just kind of one of those moments that happened. And I thought, I thought to myself, well, you know, that I can't let that ever happen to me again. And what he just did to me, maybe I can do to somebody else. So I took that moment to learn, how can I be different than other fighters, as that guy was just to me. So I taught myself to be left-handed. I was right-handed, and I thought to myself, okay, so everything I started doing left-handed. I started eating my food left-handed, cutting my food, brushing my teeth, everything left-handed, to teach myself to do things differently, because I won't be able to fight as Rocky versus the Russian, Ivan Drago. He can't fight in the same style. So we had to do things differently. And that's exactly what I taught myself at a young age. And that's the one way that I was able to survive.
Everyone sort of understands, and you've already alluded to it, that fighting is sort of naturally being whittled out of the sport for, you know, potentially good reasons as well. But when you look back on highlights, one thing that I notice is that, like, the actual fights that happened then and what happens now are completely different. Do you know why the fights themselves have changed so much? Because it seems like now it's more of a duty, where you protect yourself first and you get through it. When before it was, you know, it was trying to free up that left hand so you could actually not be the one that hits the ice first.
And the one thing I never really fought out of being like hate. Like, I think those are the moments that you can never really get to, and you can't ever lose control. And I think but I would never be at a point, you said, to continuing. Like, I watch so many people get into a fight. I have to get mad or get myself to that point if I'm going to do it. You know, back then it was way different. There was more like, you know, I play with Wayne Gretzky, you know, you're hitting Wayne Gretzky. I got to, for our team to be the best, Wayne has to be the best. So if someone's throwing Wayne off, how can we throw that guy off his game to make sure Wayne can have the most success possible. And so there was all reasoning to it. And sometimes, you know, I always wish to hurt someone, but never to hurt someone. Like, I want to intimidate them almost like, that temporary bruise that you're hurt in that game for something that you've been doing to my better players. But I really don't want to hurt you. It's just kind of the thought process of it. You know, there was so much into it back then, changing the score. There was intimidation, retribution, trying to get the crowd into it, trying to get your team going. There's so many different reasons. I think there was way different style of hockey back then, and more or less a more North American feel to the game. So we all grew up with it. We all grew up with that that history and understanding of it. Whereas now today, it's the best players in the world that have different skill sets and have grown up playing the game differently than a lot of the North American players have with the history that they have. And so we've kind of used the term whittled. The game has whittled out the fourth line, 5-6 defensemen that were there to be the intimidator, to be the one guy that'll go out and be like, okay, now this is what you get. Now you got to be able to skate and compete. You know, the Ryan Reeves, the Wilson in Washington, you got to be able to be a good hockey player, be physical, and be tough. Because they don't want to waste a spot for someone that, you know, I couldn't cross over both ways. I can't, you know, if the puck came near me, I get all excited during the game, you know. But it's not like that anymore. You got to be able to, the game's way faster. The rules have changed. You got to be able to compete on every shift at every time. So the players have changed. The fourth lines are now penalty killers, power play specialists, face-off guys. And that role is no longer there. So it's different. Guys of today, they don't have that same hate and understanding, I think, of the role. And I miss it for entertainment value.
Right.
But you have to understand the reason why it's out of the game. Or woodly now.
Yeah. Every player has a career arc. You know, they start with some, you know, some rookie lumps, and they sort of they travel up on a straight line trajectory, and then they hit their peak, and then they come back down when their skills start to diminish a little bit. So does every fighter have a peak or a career arc like that?
Great question. Now, are you talking offensively? Because I kept it exactly this way, and I did this. The secret is never give them too much. You know, always keep it flat. And that's exactly what I did. You know, if I got 2 goals in a year, the next year they'd ask for 3. And then the year after that, they'd ask for 4. But if you keep it consistently at 1, you know, offensively, that part was – and then the fighting part is the part that you're asking about.
Yeah, I'm asking you. All of a sudden not Rocky anymore at some point is what I'm getting at.
I never was Rocky. But there is times where it is tough to do, where your teammates don't appreciate it as much. It's hard for yourself to slow yourself down because you want to do whatever you possibly can do to make an impact for yourself, for the crowd, for the team, for the momentum of the game, for many different reasons. And you've been playing that way all the time. It's hard to stop. But it's also a hard job to do night after night when it's not appreciated. And it's not fun to get punched in the head for a guy that's not willing to appreciate what you, like, if I'm jumping, it's fun saying Wayne Gretzky because you got the Oilers jersey behind you, so we'll say that. So if Wayne didn't appreciate Dave Semenko wouldn't have been there, and right. Dave wouldn't have continue to keep doing it. You know, it's just kind of, it's that I appreciate you, you appreciate me. There is an arc where you get to that, I think peak is where you get experience and you get to, for me, there's never really a peak. It was kind of, you know, you're always learning. I got hurt at 28 and was done, but there's a lot that goes into the fight preparation. And there's not a lot of fun after the fight. Right. So sooner or later, that becomes tiresome. You can't get your hands in your gloves because they're swollen, the busted fingers, ligaments and stuff. That part's not fun. But if you come into the locker room and the guys come back from 2-0 after your fight and come back and score three goals. And the first person they come to see is you in the room. If the coach appreciates you and what you just did, he throws you out on the first line for some shifts just to say, thank you. So, you know, thank you. That makes you want to keep doing it. That is what encourages you to keep really wanting to work on that role. There's a couple teams that I played on. One, that role wasn't really appreciated.
When you mentioned getting your hands back in the gloves and the busted up knuckles and all that, when does like the adrenaline rush fade in that 5 minutes in the box? And it actually is just like, okay, I'm now sitting here and I'm in quite a bit of pain.
Well, good point. It is all adrenaline. Like so many people don't understand that it is. I never really got too carried away in a fight. It was all controlled breathing. It was all, you know, thinking a kind of a chess match. I know it looks like it's a fast pace, but there's hand grips being changed. There's little elbow movements. There's just ducking your head. There's all little things that kind of happen. And you're in that. And I remember one night where I fought Rob Ray, and Rob Ray landed like a lucky 17 rights in a row. And I go back to the box and like, nothing's really, the fight ends. And I go back to the box and my face starts throbbing. And I'm like, this is not good. You know, this is something's wrong. So the first thing you do is I look over at the clock guys that are in there, like 10 clock guys in there just to put the on and off button. I never really understood that. So I look at them and they're like, hey, good job, PJ. And I'm like, okay, so I'm not bleeding too bad. I took the towel on my face. There's no blood. I look to the left and then all the fans are all stuck up against the glass and they're all like, screaming. So I'm like, okay, that's not bad. Okay, whatever. But my face starts to throb. And I put, you know, you do this and you don't really feel anything. Then I go to take a sip of my water and it drools on the side of my mouth. And I'm like, something's not right here. So the problem is with that 5 minutes in the penalty box, it's 5 minutes like of not on the clock, but it's 5 minutes of hockey time. It could be a half hour by the time the 5 minutes of the game roll by. So I'm sitting there, I look back at those guys in the suits and like, they're not saying anything. And my face is, I can hardly drink my water. I finally wait, you know, 25 minutes later, I get out of the box. My face is throbbing. I go over to the bench and Robbie Fatorik is with the Boston Bruins. Robbie Fatorik goes, way to go, Stalker, get back out there. And I'm like, get Donnie. Donnie was our trainer. He's like, you don't want to go? I'm like, get Donnie. So Donnie Del Negro is still the great trainer with the Boston Bruins, comes down and Donnie looks over at my face and Donnie's like, Stalker, you okay? And I'm like, look at the other side. He looks at the other side and I had a huge hole in my face from my zygoma bone, which goes over your jaw, kind of caving in. So he's like, yeah, we have a problem here. So the moment of being in that fight and the adrenaline and everything can cover up the fact that half of my face was busted off. So it was one of those ones that, you know, the adrenaline and the energy do mask a lot of the bubbles. And that was one of the worst ones.
Well, I hope your face isn't throbbing, reliving these memories, but I'll ask you one
more.
You are,
yeah. You're all over me. I thought we were going to talk about some offsides or something. You're like, PJ, remember when you got punched in the face? I've been having like PTSD.
Okay, one more then. One more and it's not.
One more.
Nothing painful. Good moments. Just the better feeling. Waving to a road crowd or a home crowd after a fight.
Oh, you know what? The road crowd, I never really like to do. I just like to do it sometimes when they were kind of happen a little bit more in younger leagues. But in the NHL, another moment was in the only real time I kind of got a little carried away with myself. Again, the adrenaline of the moment. You get too excited. That's me in a nutshell. You know, sometimes it gets the best of me. And this, I'm with the Boston Bruins. We're playing in, I think, 2002. Playoffs, and I scored in the game in game four in the first round of the Stanley Cup Finals, and we're playing against my old team in my town, the Montreal Canadiens, and we're on the road, I'm the Boston Bruins, and I score early in the game. I think the score is 5-2 or 5-1 or something. There's like 2 minutes left to go in the game, and we get a power play. So my coach, back to that appreciation thing, puts our line out for some power play. A, you don't want to put your best power play line on to kind of A, mock the opposition. B, right. You want to rest them. And C, let's give Stalker and his line a chance because he touched the puck for once tonight. So, you know, we go out there and Michel Therrien is the coach of the Montreal Canadiens at that time. And Michel coached against me, and he was the coach of the Canadiens when they traded me. He was the coach in the American Hockey League and always fought against me. And here he is. He goes and puts his Gino Ochek, big tough guy, out there against me. And I'm like, come on, man. I'm on the power play. I've never been on the power play. Like, and not only that, he lines up against me. And I'm like, come on, man. Like, I can't go to another wing. I'm stuck out here at center ice in the Bell Center. Big playoff game. I know what my role is. Everyone on my bench is yelling, don't do it. Don't fight PJ. Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, come on. You can't do this to me. I'm looking at their coach, and Michel's kind of nodding his head, and Gino's tapping his stick, and there's a picture where he's poking me in the eye. And then finally, I'm like, ah! And we start punching. Anyways, the fight ends, and as I'm going off the ice, I wave to the crowd. I hold my jersey up. I'm just – it's one of those moments that I love and I regret. So it's kind of like one of those – I don't know. I just been punched in the head a bunch of times. I don't know why I did it. It's just adrenaline gets the best of you sometimes. So never meant to disrespect anyone by ever doing it. Sometimes it wants to play with people's minds, and especially the crowd.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's definitely a part of the entertainment factor for the home crowd. Yeah. But when your hand is forced in a away crowd, I don't think anyone can hold that against you. Not your fault at all. Let's go to the big talking point today, since I don't want any more PTSD. And the big thing after Tim Peel was, sorry?
I think I need a nap after that conversation.
You need a nap or a Tylenol at least. Yeah. So the controversy over Tim Peel being dropped by the NHL and because he was, you know, caught on a hot mic saying that he basically wanted to give Detroit a power play to, whether it was to make up for a call or to sort of level the playing field, whatever it was, it happened. And now he's been dropped by the NHL a couple weeks before his retirement. But the idea of referees managing a game is not new. I mean, make up calls, even up calls, purposely miss calls. This is something that we've always sort of understood about this game. So what was your reaction to the decision to, you know, drop Peel? And how aware were you as a player of referees manipulating certain situations based on either their mistakes, injustices that are happening in the game, flow, etc. How prevalent was that, and how much were you aware of that happening, or were you at all?
They're human. You know, that's the one thing that we all forget. The players are human too. You know, fans forget that too because they make so much money. And then the referees are human too. You forget that as well. Like, there's so much human error to so much. And sometimes what influence a lot of our actions is, you know, I was telling you before about fighting. And if I didn't feel appreciated, it was hard to go do my job. A referee, I'm not saying it should ever happen, but, you know, there are some nights where, let me just pick a superstar, because I played, you know, let's say Wayne Gretzky, because we said Wayne before in the jersey. And I'm not saying it's Wayne, but I'm just going to say, let's say Wayne Gretzky's yelling at a referee all night.
Yeah.
That referee's not going to give a penalty to Wayne Gretzky. That referee is going to be like, Wayne, slow down. He's not going to give a superstar on the team, like a Sidney Crosby, like a Connor McDavid, a little different today, but you wouldn't give that guy a penalty. The next time anyone else on your third or fourth line does anything somewhat questionable, you understand it. You know, it goes back. I didn't think about it as much until I finished playing, and I was a referee in a charity event in the final. And I'm refereeing the charity game, and I'm giving the red calls, and I think I'm doing well. These old guys are just they're giving me all the business. And I'm like, excuse me? And I felt like, how can you talk to me like that? Like, what is this? Like, but I think back to my career, and that's how we talk to referees. And you know what? Sometimes that non-robot part of them you know, has, you know, they have feelings sometimes. Why he's made that call, why he said that. He was talking to his partner. We don't know why he said it. We don't know. But we're speculating. I understand what the league has to do because there's so many reasons why we're thinking that he did say it. Was there a makeup call? Did he want to make to give a call to the Predator just because they've been, you know, I didn't watch the game, so this is what I lost that. Were they being donkeys the whole last period and he wanted to calm, did he want to calm them down? Was their coach yelling at them so much that he wanted to calm the coach down? Did he just keep call three penalties in a row against Detroit and wanted to get, like, there's so many things that go into it. And I don't know, but this is the part where you have humans making the calls and it's fast. You say things that you don't always mean. I've got penalties that I knew I didn't do anything, but it was a makeup call for something else that happened. It is what it is. Tim Peel being taken out, you have to. Unfortunately, you don't want the referees to, I forget how many games he's repped. I want to say it's like 1,900 or something crazy.
I think it was like 1,350, something like that.
1,350, crazy number. And you don't want it to be remembered as just this. But it's been going around forever. It's like that in every sport. Where you have humans involved making decisions, this is kind of what you're going to get. Unfortunately, and it doesn't look great.
Yeah, I mean, as long as it's not machines, there's going to be some emotion involved in it. But
well, what do you think? I'm going to ask you, what do you think he was doing on that play?
Well, I think for sure that we have some sort of manipulation from referees in terms of, okay, they don't want to be perceived as being biased towards a team that just got four straight power plays. So the next one, we're gonna watch things a little bit closer because you know, we want at the end of the night for it to not be 4-0 in penalties or 5-0. It's better if it's maybe 5-2 by the end of the night, just because that dictates exactly what the game sort of, or closer to what the game would be perceived as.
The optics,
fair,
though,
I guess.
Right. Yes, it's the optics. That's what we're worried about. That's exactly your point, though. But it shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be. The game should be called exactly as it is, you would think. I mean, if a team's absolutely dominating and they deserved 8 penalties and the other team deserves 0 penalties, then that's, you know, that's probably what it should be. But I could see why you'd want to avoid that situation because of all the emotion that not even is associated with you. It's the other team getting upset and mad that they feel like they've been sort of hard done by in that situation. I think that's where it comes in. But I think where this situation is different, or the key factor, you mentioned that he was talking to his referee partner, but apparently Matt Duchene said this morning that he was actually telling the Predators bench that this is what his intention was. So I'm wondering if you ever heard that, where a referee would come to the bench and say, I had to call one against you guys because of this, or something like that, because that seems a little bit offside in terms of like how a referee should be conducting themselves.
We would get warnings. Like, if you guys, you know, again, I've never sworn, but there are players in the NHL that swear every now and then. And every now and then, it goes on throughout a game. And maybe it goes on throughout a week when you have the same referee. And it adds up. It does add up. And sooner or later, it's like, hey, if Billy doesn't shut up, I'm giving you guys two. I don't care who's getting it. I'm going to give someone two. Right? It's just going to be like, that's the human element that you have, right? It's kind of like, did he give that penalty to kind of calm down the bigger picture? I don't like, again, but the NHL loves that there's mics everywhere. Like, the players hate it. Everyone wants to see this stuff. Well, now they just saw something that's one of the ugly truths of the game. It's happened. It happens all the time. Every game, the referee has to come over and say something to the bench. Like, all the time. Hey, tell Brendan to sit down and put a pipe in. Like, hey, you know, he'll talk to the head coach. If you're assistant coach here, backup goalie doesn't shut up, I'm giving you guys 2 minutes. I don't care. Like, I don't want to hear another word. Mm-hmm. But it continues. And then eventually they'll call one. And yeah, it might be a cheesy call, but he did kind of give you the warning.
The thing we hear every time there's, you know, controversy in a playoff game, involving referees is the either players or teams or executives saying, we want the players and teams to decide the game. Right. I feel like this is almost a player and team created problem because they are so adamant with that, and referees don't want to be accused of influencing the game in that regard. So, you know, the fact that we always hear this and the referees wanting to provide like an equal opportunity sort of scenario in every game, is it only because, you know, the players want this? Like, is this a player and team made problem that just affects the referees more?
I think the problem is that there's a rule book and everyone is pretty much, this is my opinion, this is not verbatim, but everyone, the rules are how these referees interpret it. That's kind of what you see. In football, from what I've witnessed, you know, a call is a call. Doesn't matter who's against, a call is a call. Hockey, and yes, there are two different sets of rules for Tom Brady, but that's okay because I like Tom Brady. But there, in hockey, there are. There's the superstar rules, and then there's the third, fourth line guy rules. There's the let's call everything or let's let the boys decide it, right? It's right. just, but one refereeing team to another ref team might be different. So there's a lot of this. And when you say let's let the guys decide it, well, often it'll be the more physical team or cheating team or whatever, the hooking team or whatever that might be able to influence the game. But the referees now, once they haven't called one, you can't call the next one. And then there's a snowball effect. Some players, some teams, everyone have a difference of opinion. Like if it was me when I played, ref, take those whistles and don't bring them out. Don't bring them out on the ice. Unless Rob Ray's coming after me again, quickly blow that down and come protect me. But if it's the Connor McDavid's of the world, anytime there's a stick on him because he's so fast, they want to call against him. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of stuck in these two worlds depending on how your team plays, who you're playing against, and then, you know, who your star player is, who their star player is, who's lined up against everyone, where you are in the standings, how important the points are, how important the next goal is. There's when you break it all down, unless they find a way to go to tennis and the robot, this is what we have.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we learned anything, it's that admission is guilt here because everyone's going to have their emotions, you know, affect how they handle a situation, especially referees and officials, because they're in such a, it's such a difficult job anyway. But when you start saying things out loud, and unfortunately, if you get caught on a hot mic and you're influencing the game, especially when the NHL is welcoming gambling now, and other things like that, like you can't have those things sort of hanging over you. And if they're kind of lucky that a guy who is about to be shown the door in terms of, you know, he's just getting up there in age and moving on, and it wasn't a 25 or 28 year old guy who might have had 2 decades ahead of him and had some promise, I think they might have lucked out in that regard.
You just said a word that I haven't even thought of, was the gambling aspect.
Yeah,
like that is kind of, if you think about that, like, you know, players are so talented and the league is, you know, the way they call things at times, it does, you know, we used to say, you know, there's the 2-goal lead is the worst lead in hockey. Now it's almost 3 because team can come back by 3 goals, boom, boom, boom. Mm-hmm. But let's say that team is down 3-0 and you, and a call like that, a chintzy call that you're just doing to make up because I want, again, I don't know why he gave the penalty, but whatever. And that team now comes back into it and changes the outcome of the game. There's a lot of gambling involved. And that's why I think football, I think, is – I love football, how almost every time there's a penalty, all the referees get together. It is a good penalty. We're actually picking up that flag. You know, I don't know why hockey doesn't do that. You know, I don't know why – in football, anyone can almost call anything. I know they all have a specific area to call. I don't know why hockey doesn't have that. All the referees on the ice could have a – you know, why can't a linesman call a major penalty if you just witnessed a major penalty? So there's, and the gambling aspect is, that's why football, you have to, because there's so much money involved. Now hockey's going down that path, and here's something that is, you know, how much will it influence the gambling moving forward? It shouldn't, because gamblers are gamblers, but it does make you think twice.
You just need transparency and honesty with it, and you can't have referees who are trying to change outcomes of games when people are, and you're promoting the gambling on your space if you're the NHL, which they're preparing to do. Okay, let's get to the Habs. I don't know if we have too much time left because, again, a lot of fighting talk and referee talk. So let's get to what's that? And Tylenols is right. We'll get to a little bit of Habs talk here. But the first thing I think we have to establish is sort of what your expectations were coming into the season, because it was a busy offseason, obviously, for Mark Bergevin, perhaps inspired by a unexpected positive experience in the bubble. And he went out and improved his club because he thought that he had something here in this North Division. So where did you grade out those moves, and where do you think the Canadians were coming into this North Division as opposed to maybe where they are right now?
I've been like four different phases of Mark Bergevin up until now. So I don't like where the team was last year. They were 24th in the league. They made it into the playoffs last year, but it doesn't count because they were 24th. Like, right. In my opinion, last year, there's the guys that won it. They deserve, it was hard to do everything. But a 24th team getting into the playoffs, yeah, they had to win a little play-in series where no one played for months. There's some kind of asterisk there. So if you think about it, the Canadians hadn't been in the playoffs for the last 5 years. Their minor league club hasn't been in the playoffs, I think, seven of the last 8 years. They don't really have any upcoming prospect. There's no depth in the organization via the organizational draft chart. You know, a lot of was betting on Romanov to come over from Russia and be an impact player right away. And you know what? They were banking on two really young centermen. So I did not think that the season was going to start off all that well. I looked at, if you look at where the Canadiens' penalty killing was last year and their power play going into a division that now had Toronto, Edmonton, Calgary, and Vancouver. I forget to put a pick. Four of the top 10 power plays in the league. If I'm right, or maybe not Calgary, it's Winnipeg that's in there. Whatever. Four of the top 10 power plays in the league. And they're going to be playing them every night. That was the league, 31 teams. Now there's four of the top power plays just in their division. So I thought with the moves that they made, they didn't buy a ton of goals. No one was sure about Anderson coming off shoulder surgery with one goal, I think three assists last year. You know, Edmondson on the back end. They were 24th. They had 2 weeks in the bubble. I was not expecting much. They come out and they are unbelievable. I go from Bergevin to be fired to Bergevin wins general manager of the year like that. Like everything they touch to start the year off, everything. Foley, Anderson's batting pucks out of the air. Edmondson's unbelievable. Jake Allen's the best goalie in the world. They're winning the Stanley Cup. Like it's just, and then reality kind of kicked in. Yes. Mm-hmm. They do have two young centers that are only 20 years old. They're 20 and 21. They are up against the salary cap now. They can't really make too many changes. Their core is getting a lot older, and Carey Price and Shea Weber and Petrie and Gallagher. And, you know, their core is getting a little bit older. I think the game's won's down the middle, your defense and your goalie. And at the time, their goalie wasn't playing well, Carey Price. Their middle was two young centermen and Dano, who, poor guy, couldn't buy a goal to start the season. And their defense lacked some mobility. And then they fire a coach, come back with a new one, and they're kind of in the same space. But again, now I'm not even sure what I think. They started up there, went down here. I'll give them a few steps up right now. But, you know, they've been playing Vancouver. They played Vancouver nine times. They won six and three overtime, so they got 15 points out of a possible 18, but they don't play Vancouver anymore for the rest of the year. So now it's going to be interesting how they're going to generate as many points moving forward.
So when they did come back to earth, the decision was made to fire Claude Julien, as you mentioned. But I feel like you would divvy up the blame a little bit differently, and I think most people would. But the convenient or the easy way to solve a problem or at least address a situation is to fire the coach, because there's usually never really any other options other than a big trade or, I guess, making a change at the management position. So when they were encountering their problems, where did the blame lie from you? I mean, you mentioned you're cold on Bergevin coming in. Certain players have underperformed at the start of the year, but there's been a lot of high performers for this team as well. So what was sort of who should have been shouldering the blame that Claude Julien basically had to shoulder all by himself?
The general manager, 100%. If it wasn't a COVID world, the Canadiens would not have been in the playoffs. And what happened is we looked at 2 weeks last year or a month of the playoffs. I think we overevaluated the young players that the Montreal Canadiens had. They went out and picked up players that came in and made an impact. And those players have been making an impact. The problem is all the other players that the Canadiens have had for the last couple of years aren't right now. And the problem is they can't take players from the minors and really plug them in there because the organization has not drafted well in the last 8 years. They don't have those players that are call up, you know, they had to go sign 4 key players. You need a backup goalie. They pretty much got top four defensemen. And they were hoping Romanov came in and had a huge impact because they don't have many players that they can bring up and put into the organization. And then a lot of those players that could come up, they don't have any winning experience. They haven't been in the playoffs 6 of the last 7 years or 7 of the last 8 years. So I think a lot of it falls on 95% of it falls on the general manager. And I think some of it falls on Carey Price. And it's not so much, you know, Carey's Carey, but unfortunately we live in this world of comparables. And, you know, when your team's in this kind of a salary crunch, and you're statistically not where you probably should be. If we're talking about Toronto and Matthews and Marner aren't scoring, well, that's why that team's kind of in trouble. McDavid and Dreisaitl are making all the money in Edmonton. They're not scoring. That's in trouble. Well, Montreal's back heavy. So their back end, they have to win games 2-1, 3-1 because they don't have a ton of offense up front, but they're dealt to win games on the back end by giving $10.5 million to your goalie and paying a lot of money to your defense. Well, they're still giving up 3-4 goals a night. And whether it's the system, whether it's the defense, or whether it's the goal, whatever. And a lot of times I think Carey wasn't great at the midpoint of the season. He had a couple of good games after the coaching change, but he has to be better. They have to be better. And I don't know. I think they're built for the playoffs. I don't know if they're built for the regular season.
You mentioned things maybe not changing too much since Dominique Ducharme has come in. Only 5 of the 13 games he's coached have been wins, but they've earned a lot of points given that 5 of their 8 losses have come in extra time. You mentioned the 2 big things, I think Carey Price and obviously the change at coach. So since the change, and since maybe even more importantly, the change from Stephen Waite to Sean Burke, even though I don't even think he's in Montreal yet due to the quarantine rules, but the changes at head coach, the changes from goaltending coach, has there been a tangible change or benefit since those 2 moves were made?
Carey started playing better, which is, they changed up a little bit of their style. You know, I don't have to break it in too much, where the D weren't pinching as much and they were coming back more as a group and not trying to give up as many opportunities to opposition, which kind of helps your goalie. He had a few games in a row where he played well. And A, is it the system, or is it B, is it him? But nonetheless, you need that. Show me a good goalie, I'll show you a good coach.
Right.
And then the other thing is the special teams is a big, you know, you might not always get the goals or kill the penalties, but they're momentum swingers. We talked about fighting before. That was a big one back in the day, or big body checks. And physicality is not in the game as much anymore. So really the ebb and flows of the excitement in a game sometimes come by the energy and chances in zone offense you can generate that can maybe get a little more step in your game, get the crowd going. So the power play has shot up from, I believe, about an 18% to a mid 30%. So, I mean, that's almost double. So that's giving your offensive guys a little bit more swagger. You know, they're getting, you don't like looking at your score sheet and see zeros, not zeros, or like your stat sheet and seeing zeros on the cross. I was used to it, so I didn't mind it. I was like, yeah, hey, PJ touched the puck. Hey, look at that. PJ had a blocked shot. Like, I was pretty excited about that stuff. But these guys making $6 million and everything's comparable. I talked about Carey. Well, these guys want to compare themselves to other guys in the league as well. And they're off. The offense started to come a little bit. They've been giving up a little bit less in nets as well. So kudos to that. I don't know how much, as you said, as Burke can help because he's not necessarily there just yet. But all they're in, you know, Deshaun's already on the bench. So his voice has kind of already been heard. So it's I give credit to the power play changing. I give credit to the leadership group for starting to play better. And I give credit to the goaltending and Carey Price for changing the way that they were playing with Claude Julien got fired.
After Price, is there a line or a player or a pairing or something that shoulders more responsibility than others when it comes to the success of the Canadiens?
They don't have – this is the problem with the Montreal Canadiens. They don't have a number one center. Okay, they don't have a number – like hopefully Suzuki or Kotkaniemi will be that person long term. They don't have a real – offensive threat. They don't have a Panarin. They don't have a McDavid. They don't have a Crosby. They don't have a Stamkos. They are by committee. They are success and failure by committee. So.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Unfortunately, the superstar of the team is Carey Price. So it's easy to do. And Jonathan Drouin, for a bit, being the highest paid winger, it all fell on Jonathan Drouin as well because they traded a big prospect in Sergachev to the Tampa Bay Lightning, brought back Jonathan Drouin, and he was supposed to be, you know, the Francophone superstar that this organization has been waiting for. And I don't think as much of it is Jonathan Drouin's fault as much as a lot of people for putting the bar too high on him, because you see how much talent he has and you just want it more often. So that could be his blame as much as some of our blame. I think, unfortunately, though, you look at the position, which has always been the goaltending in Montreal, has always been open for criticism and praise. Goes back in the history of the team. Patrick was a great example. Josie Theodore, just in the most recent times. And you're the hero. The team hasn't had an offensive superstar. So you fall back on the next play. And that's, it's not your, the PK Subban was there for a bit and he had that flash, but it's hard. You couldn't blame that guy in the middle. You blame the guys that can't score or the person that lets the goal in. I think sometimes those people in the middle get left out a little, but Carey's a guy that takes a lot of the heat. And unfortunately it's, comes with the meal ticket of $10.5 million a year.
His month-long slump, I think, undid a lot of the really good stuff that Marc Bergevin was able to accomplish in the offseason. Maybe he wasn't working with the best hand coming in, but what he did in the offseason was pretty good in terms of who they brought in. And it seems because of that, there's been maybe even more positive than negatives, like Jeff Petrie, Norris conversation, Tyler Toffoli, all the goals, Josh Anderson, solid addition, Joel Edmondson, maybe – outshooting expectations. Jake Allen's been good. Romanov and Suzuki have fallen back to earth a little bit, but these are guys that are just coming into the group as well. I feel like that might, even though the money is tight, that might empower Marc Bergevin even more, and we've got the trade deadline approaching. So what are your expectations for the trade deadline for Montreal, and how would that jive with what you would do if you had the power to make the moves in Montreal?
Well, my thing is there's kind of salary cap crunched right now. So yeah. I think they have, and they're also stuck with these two, they have old guys. I'm calling them old as I'm older than all of them here with my gray beard, but you know, you have the Weber, the Petrie, by the way, like you said, all the guys that you're saying, spectacular. Like, they're all such impacts, and they're all guys that he just brought in. But, you know, there's guys that I don't like a lot of the contracts that he's given out, but that's for another day. But there's guys that are at the tail end, and there's guys that are just starting. There's a big middle gap that's not really there. And I think that's part of the problem with this team, because what's the next move? I mentioned their lack of success in the minors and development of players in the minors. You don't have that next wave coming up. Cole Caulfield, you know, hopefully can come in and maybe have some presence. But if I look at this team, prior to this year, their number one center for the last year, few years has been Philippe Danault. And Philippe Danault was struggling this year, but he's without a contract. He is your key face-off guy. He's your key experience guy, and he doesn't have a contract. Thomas Tatar has been the number one goal scorer on the team for the last 2 years. He does not have a contract. He's most probably going to have to leave at the end of the season because they don't have the money to pay him. Joel Armia. Kakanyemi doesn't have a contract for next year. Lekkonen doesn't have a contract for next year. So, you know, I was a guy that, you know, every mistake that I made was like, ah, we don't need PJ, we can replace him. These superstar guys, they work a little bit differently. They're in the league. They're worried about how much money they're going to make next year, not fall out of the league, which was my thing. I was going to fall out of the league or sit out next game. They're all playing with dollars. And every time they don't get a goal or have a bad game, it plays with their mind.
Right.
If I'm Bergevin, and if they are not part of their future plans, move them now. I would really move them now. And there's that 2 week quarantine in Canada that the players, so you can only change within your North Division if you want to make it. But the problem is everyone's in it. Besides Ottawa, everyone's right in it. So I think you have to look down to the States. And now that the Canadians, I don't want to say fortunately, unfortunately, I'm not PC and I don't want to come up with the wrong word, but they have quarantine going on in their team right now because they have COVID issues. They're not playing for a week. So if you were to make a trade now, you do cut off 7 days of that potentially player having to miss a week of hockey. So now instead of missing 2 weeks, they might only miss one. So I would really be crunching right now thinking about, what am I doing with Philippe Danault? This team doesn't win with Philippe Danault. But if he's not signing here, I'm not losing him for nothing and going into next year with three centermen under 22 years old. Am I not losing Tatar for nothing? He's my number one goal scorer 2 years in a row. Am I going to lose him for absolutely nothing? Can I not get something for him? You know, there's Joel Armia. I think they have to identify their team right now and address it and make moves now. If not, I don't think there will be another move made. I don't think there will be.
And perhaps not get blinded by the fact that they're, you know, going to be in a postseason position. They are right now. They could be by the end of the year, or they should be by the end of the year. And maybe that shouldn't factor into everything that they're planning, because it's beyond this season. It's building for the future still.
It is building for the future. But if you're building for the future, that's why the trades for me happen now, because if not, you lose three players for nothing at the end of next year. And your core just aged another year, and you're going to have to bring in another young player that's going to need another year of growing, which means that Carey Price is 36. Shea Weber is 34. Petrie is going to be 34. Gallagher's in 30s. Like, every year that the youth guys get better, the older guys are aging as well. So they're kind of stuck in these two opposites, and that's because of a lot of years of poor drafting where they don't have those middle guys. And that's, I think, part of the problem with this team.
Two more for you, because I know we're running a little bit past time, and you can be quick on these if you'd like. The Jeff Petrie Norris Trophy buzz, is it legitimate?
It is legitimate, and I do not want to say this, but honestly, I have not watched enough of the other divisions. I watched when I was with
it's
Hockey
tough
Night.
Up here.
It's tough. Like, it's tough. Hockey every night. And it's every second night. And if you're watching a specific team like Montreal, so you're missing a lot of those other games. I used to sit in my basement and that's all I did was, you know, you TiVo some games and watch some live, you had picture in picture. Now I focus a little bit more on Montreal, on the North Division, and I have my favorites. I like watching, you know, my old Flyers play, my Bruins play, and my Rangers play. And, you know, it's hard to watch the West Conference. It's hard because this division also has their Western time slots as well. The Northern Division also has the West. So you kind of don't have the split like they used to. So it has been hard. So Norris, for what he's done for the Montreal Canadiens, he's been spectacular. And he might have actually covered up some warts for this team that, you know, that are there. But he's been really great. To compare him to other divisions and players in other division, I wouldn't be doing the other guys justice.
Last one for you. My theory based on this season and watching this season unfold is that we've overlooked matchups in the NHL for too long, or the idea that, you know, one team is just built to beat another. And Montreal's sort of a shining example of that, right? They've dominated the Canucks, as you mentioned before, but they're not going to play the Canucks in the postseason, it seems. So who then would the Canadiens match up best against in the postseason if they do, in fact, make the postseason, just to put them in the best position to potentially advance?
Well, their back end lacks mobility. So this is the question. Right now, as I'm saying this, as we talk, McDavid is on another planet offensively. So that's not a good matchup. And if I'm thinking the Montreal Canadiens, you know, Weber is normally your shutdown guy. His pairing, I would not have that pairing. I put a more mobile defenseman, which would be the Petrie duo against McDavid. So, you know, then you have, you know, it's Toronto. Toronto is, they could score. They do have some questions on defense every now and then, as does Edmonton. But Montreal doesn't have that game breaker with speed, but Montreal can kind of clog them up. And there's Winnipeg right now, but we're talking about the top four that would be in. Mm-hmm. I would say I love Winnipeg. I'd say they match up. This is going to sound crazy. I'm just going to contradict myself, but you're going to blame it on the concussion from being punched in the head. I'm going to say they match up best against Edmonton because they don't have as many players to shut down. They have a back end that has issues at times. I think Dave Tippett has done an amazing job with that team, but we're at the midpoint. We're not at the tail end. So it'll be interesting to see how they finish the year. As of today, there's still too many question marks for that team. And it goes by when I saw Toronto play Edmonton and the way they controlled Edmonton, I have to give a check mark to Toronto there. And that Winnipeg team just suckers me in every year. I pick them every year because they can do so many things so well. Great goaltending, great offense, depth. Their blue line is the iffy question as well, but I think they have more depth up front than the Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think if I had to choose it from a Montreal perspective, I'd go Edmonton because McDavid's going to do his damage on anyone. Yeah, so it's about mitigating everything else, and you could probably zero into everyone else on that team with the defense core that they have, but it's about, you know, if McDavid's going to get you, he's going to get you. And I think they probably match up the best against that team just for that reason alone, because it's not much after McDavid. Maybe you can get a few on Mikko Koskinen and Mike Smith. PJ, I really appreciate this. I hope you're not reaching for an ice bag after this interview. I didn't
want a drink.
There was no intention there. It was a great conversation, and I appreciate you indulging me on some fighting talk as well.
Awesome. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.